Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Measuring the sound of rockets. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA's recent launch of the Artemis 1 mission was really loud. That's according to new data collected by physics researchers. The team placed microphones across the area during the historic launch of NASA's SLS rocket. Well, just how loud was it? And why is it important to understand the behavior of sound? We'll hear from those researchers about the science of sound. Then, what does a member of NSYNC and the fall of the Soviet Union have in common? A space podcast, of course. We'll hear from NSYNC member Lance Bass about his new podcast, The Last Soviet. From rocket sounds to NSYNC, we've got a great show. This, I promise you, just ahead on Are We There Yet? Here on 90.7 WMFE News. The launch of NASA's moon rocket, SLS, last year was really loud. That's according to new research, which aimed to better understand rocket noise. A team of researchers used microphones across Central Florida to measure decibel levels of this historic launch. The data found sound levels 3 miles from the launch pad were the equivalent of standing next to a jet aircraft taking off. Here to talk more about these sound findings and why they matter are Rollins College professor Whitney Coyle and Brigham Young University professor Kent Gee. Whitney, Kent, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
So the Artemis 1 launch, I was there. It was quite loud. That is my lay term for it. But you are scientists, and you've actually measured the loudness of Artemis 1. Scientifically speaking, how loud was this launch?
It was quite loud up for the people up close. We were actually quite far away making measurements, and so where we were sitting, it wasn't very loud. 18 or 20 miles away, but at 5 kilometers away, it was about 130 decibels, right? Which is the kind of sound levels that you associate with a jet engine taking, jet aircraft taking off.
That's quite loud.
You were close to it, right? But you're 5 kilometers away, right? So it's quite a sound level.
Whitney, how did you actually make these measurements? What was the process, and what equipment did you use?
So it was a long process from start to finish, but one of the things we had to do was get permission to actually be on base at Kennedy Space Center. And so we had quite a few stations set up around the base, which we could only get to with escorts, which was logistically very tricky. And then we also set up so all of those were unmanned. We weren't able to stay on base during the actual launch. So we had to set them up, more logistical situation with all the solar panels for all the batteries that we had to get for all of our equipment. So we were running multiple microphones and computers from these stations that we weren't able to get to until, 12 hours after the launch to make sure that we actually had acquired the data that we hoped to get. And then we had manned stations. So our students were the ones that got to be a lot closer. So I'm not sure how close was the.
They were about 8 to 10 miles away.
8 to 10 miles. So in Titusville, and in a couple other locations on the bridge, which was very cool. And they had microphones with them as well. And then Dr. Gee and myself and a few other professors were kind of between the launch and Rollins College in order to get kind of a long range propagation data between there and where we are stationed all the time. So it's very cool.
But unlike using your phone, right, to record, video or whatever, the instrumentation is scientific grade hardware. We would use to make measurements. So the data we got are we know they're accurate because of the quality of the instrumentation that we were using.
It was just kind of like a a microphone, or is it something a little more complex than that to make these measurements?
It's a microphone, with a digitizer, then gets fed into a computer. But the microphone itself has a very good response all the way from the very lowest frequencies in the rocket signal all the way up to the very highest frequencies. And rocket mm-hmm. noise is unique because it's all the way below our range of human hearing, all the way to above our range of human hearing, which is from mm-hmm. about 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. But rockets span that entire range and then some. And so to be able to capture both the rumble of the noise, right, and then kind of the crackling of the noise, you've got to capture that entire frequency range.
Mm-hmm. Whitney, maybe we should take a step back here, and let me ask you this. Why is it important to understand the sound levels of this rocket, for one, and in different locations? There are multiple locations you've had these instruments out there. Why is it important to kind of collate all of this data?
Right. So as of right now, because that was the first launch of this type of rocket, we don't have a source characterization. We don't actually know. Like, everyone has these kind of ideas of what might happen, but because the launch has not happened with that rocket, we didn't know. So a few of the things is we don't know level. So of course we could just kind of stand around with the sound level meter, but we also don't know directivity. So where the sound is actually, first of all, going to come from, and then how it will travel from the source out to wherever our receiver might be. So our receivers could be, of course, our microphones, but it could also be your ears. And depending on meteorological effects, ground effects, if the ground is hard or soft, there are lots of different things that are going to affect how that sound will get to your ear or our microphone. And so being able to take these measurements at multiple locations all the way kind of around the launch and also at different distances away from the launch will help us to be able to eventually model the sound so we can start to make predictions for future launches so that we can, yeah, better inform the community, but also just in general understand rocket noise.
Mm-hmm. Kent, I'm reading this piece in phys.org, and you're quoted saying that there's some misinformation out there about sound waves from Saturn V, like the fact that it melted concrete and caused grass fires. You can say that's not true, right? And no concrete was melted after Artemis I.
We can absolutely say that that's not true. The sound levels, right, are, you know, required to melt concrete are just simply non-physical. But it's just amazing. You know, there's a lot of well-meaning individuals out there on Reddit and other platforms that start calculating some numbers and then they put them out there. And then the next person says, well, look at that. And that must mean this, you know. And the next thing you know, you created this legend, right? So this legend of the Saturn V that just was completely non-physical. So we had written a previous article about that, you know, the sound levels were loud, but much more reasonable and kind of explaining some of the physics. And so part of the purpose of these measurements and this paper and to get it out quickly was to say, you know, the levels are not going to melt concrete, not going to cause fires. But it's important to know what they are for some of those reasons that Whitney mentioned. We don't know very well how to, you know, what those sound levels are going to be near a rocket and far away from the rocket. And so presently rockets and payloads are over-designed because we mm-hmm. don't, they, with the safety margin, so that they're more massive than they probably need to be. And so if we had a better idea of that sound, we could actually optimize or make more efficient rockets that were less massive, required less fuel, and get up to space cheaper. And so mm-hmm. lots of reasons for that.
Mm-hmm. Whitney, when it comes to the Artemis launch specifically, you know, where is this sound coming from? Kent described it perfectly, you know, what I experienced there at the press site. There was that rumble. There's the crackle. Where does the sound actually come from on the rocket? Do we know?
So based on a recent article by one of Ken's colleagues, actually at BYU, it's actually as the rocket is going up, there are a lot of sources there. So potentially the flame trench, a lot of noise is coming from that impingement of the jet from the rocket onto the flame trench and down. But as the rocket is going up, that's what we're going to hear. That's what's going to propagate to us. And that's coming from the plume under the rocket. So when you can measure down, I don't know exactly the distance, 13.
I mean,
nozzle diameters underneath the rocket is actually what we would consider the source of the noise that is going to come from, that's going to come to us eventually. But there are lots of different places, of course.
Uh-huh. And that noise is caused by just the turbulent interaction of that plume with the air. And so that turbulence kind of reaches a maximum kind of efficiency. Yeah. A certain number of, we like to talk about things in scaling. And so a certain number of nozzle diameters, but that's going to be 50 or 100 meters below the rocket is where the dominant noise is coming from. And so that's part of the purpose of these studies is to start understanding more where is the noise coming from and what are its characteristics.
Mm-hmm. What role does weather play in how the sound is kind of propagated throughout the area? Did you look at temperature, humidity, all of that stuff?
Yeah, we've been looking at that a lot because we have we have students working on these projects, and one of the things that I have is a propagation model. So how we can kind of predict the sound that's going to propagate from a source, so the sound leaving a source. And in that model, I need to know the humidity, temperature, wind speed, and direction, because that is going to affect the levels that are received, again, by the ear or the microphone. And so one of the things we noticed with this really interesting night launch is that we have different locations where microphones were, coming out kind of around the rocket, but they're at different distances away. So we had one microphone that was, I suppose, due west about 20 miles due west towards Rollins. And then another one that was basically south towards Cocoa Beach. They were about the same distance away. And one of our microphones got about 100 decibels. The other one got nearly nothing. So, and we have two people that were at that station saying, we saw it, we saw the light, we saw that it was going up, there was a rocket, and we didn't hear a thing. So we are pretty sure, we can't say for certain, but we are pretty sure that there are some very interesting weather effects, potentially ground effects, but more likely weather effects that were happening between our rocket and our microphones there.
Mm-hmm. What's next? I mean, is there a plan to do this for the next Artemis launch, for other heavy launch vehicles like Falcon Heavy and possibly Starship and the Super Heavy booster when it launches from Kennedy Space Center? Are you going to slap some more mics on those launches?
Absolutely.
That's absolutely the hope. The reason for doing that, right, number one, we want to provide meaningful opportunities for students, right? These are amazing training opportunities. But the second reason is that we have such a poor understanding of the source physics. We don't understand how it's traveling to the receiver, like Whitney said, and we don't understand how people and animals are hearing or perceiving the noise and what's startling, what's damaging, what's annoying. And so by gathering as much data as possible from different types of rockets, particularly these bigger rockets, right? Like as you mentioned, Falcon Heavy, Starship, things like that, we can start to predict those effects and look at what kinds of impacts they're having on the payloads, the launch pad structures, and then farther away, the communities and the environment.
It was Rollins College professor Whitney Coyle and Brigham Young University professor Kent Gee. Still to come, our conversation with NSYNC's Lance Bass about his new podcast, The Last Soviet. Are We There Yet? Is back in a minute.
Thank you. Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on 90.7 WMFE News. I'm Brendan Byrne. NSYNC's Lance Bass was a global superstar in his boy band days. You may also remember he trained to go to space. That mission on a Soyuz capsule in the early 2000s never happened, but it did continue to scratch Bass's itch for space. His newest venture is hosting the podcast The Last Soviet, which tells the story of cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev's 313 days stranded in space when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. Lance Bass, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Lance, the podcast is called The Last Soviet. It chronicles cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev's 313 days stranded in space after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Lance, first of all, where did you come across this story? It's so fascinating.
Well, originally I heard this story when I was training over in Russia. I was so fascinated with other cosmonauts because, of course, in America, we learn all about our Apollo astronauts, but didn't get too much on Yuri Gagarin and all these other famous cosmonauts that they had. So learning about these guys, especially from the guys who put them in space, because no one has really left Star City. It's the same people that put Gagarin up are pretty much there today. Even Sergei is there, you know, one of the heads of Russian, you know, space program. So, you know, just talking about Gagarin and all these other ones, this is one of the stories that I was told because Sergei was working on the military base. And I just thought it was so fascinating to hear about life before the ISS, you know, the mirror days, mm-hmm. the small stations. And I had never heard about Krikalev's story, especially being stranded in space 313 days in the fall of communism and Soviet Union. It was such an insane time, and how his patriotism took over, and he might not agree with half of what his country is doing, but as a patriot, just stayed up there and decided to man the last, you know, outpost for his country.
You know, you the story happened in 91. You came across it when you were training some two decades ago. Why is it relevant now? Why is it important to hear this story now?
Well, I think it's relevant to hear stories like this because, you know, space has always been about politics. And a lot of people don't really realize that. You know, we get caught up in the whole patriotism of it all and the exploration, and even the cosmonauts and the astronauts, they have the love of space. They're going to do their job and they don't really get into the politics of it all. But they've always been used by their governments, you know, with politics always being, you know, the puppet of it all. Mm-hmm. It's nice to understand this history and see how it unfolded, especially in a time of the fall of the Soviet Union that we all think we know what happened, but to see it from the eyes of everyone that lived it, especially from the space program, and especially from a cosmonaut that was, you know, lied to himself. Mm-hmm. You know, half the time he was up there, he didn't know what was happening. The only way that he knew the real news was from a girl in Australia that he would connect with on the ham radio that his country didn't even know he was talking to. So he was getting all this, you know, side information of what was going on, not knowing what was happening with his family down there on Earth, and especially his just few month old baby.
Mm-hmm. That's the fascinating part of this story, is how he maintained that connection to Earth despite, you know, that ham radio is absolutely bonkers, that's how he stayed connected, right?
I mean, you have to do something. I mean, look, the ISS is a grand hotel compared to what he experienced. Yeah. So, and I'm glad that he was able to get to the ISS. He was the first one on there. So, like, I'm so glad that he got to do both. Uh-huh. But there is a serious thing called space madness, you know, and you will go crazy in space, especially with, you know, no one to really talk to, just doing your daily duties every single day has got to be so monotonous. So having that outlet to be able to talk to someone that you eventually considered a friend, to kind of catch you up on life and what it's like down there, it's the only thing that kept him sane.
Mm-hmm.
Lance, I've had a chance to talk to a lot of U.S. astronauts. So it's interesting to hear your perspective talking about cosmonauts. But as you alluded to earlier in our conversation, it does seem like that, you know, space kind of transcends politics and boundaries down here on Earth. Is that the sense you got when you were training in the early 2000s?
Yes. I loved the camaraderie between Russia and America in the space programs. Everyone just respects each other, and they do stay out of the politics of it all. And, you know, it's the only thing that we have that I feel like the Earth is in it together. You know, we all want to advance our planet together by experimenting in space, exploring space. The ISS, how many countries have come together on this one little bitty, you know, machine. But we're all doing it for one reason, to make sure that everyone on Earth advances in a better way. It's not just for the countries. Everything we discover as America or Russia discovers for Russia, it's all going to be shared at some point. And it's just really just bettered our planet as a whole. And it's not, there are no borders in space. Mm-hmm. At least for now.
Yeah. Lance, let's go back to when you were training there in 2002. Why the heck did you want to leave the planet in the first place? What was your motivation to take on this mission?
Exploration. I think maybe watching Indiana Jones a few times made me that just the excitement of discovery has always been with me since a little kid. And there was always space around me. So my grandfather loved space. My dad, my great uncle, who was, you know, an amazing World War II pilot, who lived at Merritt Island right next to Cape Canaveral. They've always been fascinated with it, and they kind of rubbed off on me. So watching movies like Space Camp, even weirdly enough, growing up on Nickelodeon and watching Double Dare, and the winner would go to space camp, and I'd always dream, like, I want to go to space camp. They would show all this amazing footage of these kids having the best time. And so I eventually went to space camp. And finally, my dad took me down to Cape Canaveral. I saw my first launch. And seeing that just really solidified my love for space and just going somewhere that most men do not get to go. I want to be that person. So I knew then that was my path. And I found out I had to, you know, become a space engineer first, and then maybe you would be able to get into an astronaut class. So, you know, I had the right path in mind. And then all of a sudden NSYNC just kind of landed in my lap. Like, okay, I guess we'll go on this path instead.
I'm glad you mentioned the movie Space Camp, because that was one of my favorite growing up, and I feel like that's a very underrated movie, but it seems like that's a through line from a lot of people that do have a passion for space. So you did NSYNC, but you also had the chance to train on this mission. Lance, you trained in a Soyuz capsule. That was going to be your trip up to space. I've seen pictures of a Soyuz capsule. It does not look comfortable at all. What was it like sitting in one of those things?
It's miserable. And even my mock missions, I didn't even have my bundles of clothes and everything. That makes it even tighter. But you get to know your crew very well. You're on top of them. Most people don't understand that your knees are in your chest. You're in a ball, but you're there for hours. And so after a few minutes, your body just goes dead from waist down. So you can't feel a thing. And you know, you're having little rods that you're having to push buttons, and it's intense, because, you know, my training was condensed into a very short 6-month training, which should take years. And it's not like the shuttle where you can sit in a seat and be like, oh, I can just be a tourist and this is great. No, you actually had things you had to do that would, you know, save your crew's life. So, you know, I was in charge of oxygen and that type of stuff. So you had to really know what you were doing so that you don't kill your crew. But it is not a fun flight. You definitely do it for the love of it. And a lot of people don't understand too is, yeah, it's like you shoot up to space, you're great, but no, you still have 2 days to get to the ISS, chasing that ISS in this very small, like, call it the BO. And you're just sitting there with your crew doing, you know, if you can have some experiments you can do in that 2 days, great. But most of the time you're sitting there bored as hell, holding the bathroom from one of your crew members.
That does not sound very fun at all. Lance, I mean, 20 years ago, you were kind of blazing a new path with this private space mission. But since then, these private space missions are they're happening more frequently with the likes of SpaceX. Do you ever think that you'll try again? Is space in your future?
Yeah, I mean, I think space is in everyone's future. I love what they're doing with privatizing space. It only advances us quicker, especially for experiments and, you know, not having to wait for space on the ISS or the Soyuz, which is, there's a long line to get up to the ISS. But with these other, you know, rockets going off, it's great. We can get to our experiments a lot quicker. And for a lot of people, just to go up to space and float around, that's good enough for them. It's a great roller coaster. That was never my want. I don't think I would ever go with Virgin or anything like that. I mean, unless someone just gave me a ticket to go, sure. But I don't think I would ever need to go. You know, my dream is still to, I mean, obviously my experiments are very dated, so I would have to choose something different, but my dream is to, you know, get a company behind me that needs to send an astronaut to space to do their experiments. You know, I was doing blood studies and environmental studies on the ISS, lived there for 10 days. And you know, I wanted to do something that meant something, mm-hmm. and help advances. I wasn't there just to kind of float around and take pictures for Instagram.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lance, if you want to do another podcast in space and you need a podcast producer, please feel free to reach out to me. More than happy to help.
First time in space, yes.
But and finally, Lance, with your podcast, The Last Soviet, what do you want listeners to take away from this?
I love history, and we learn so much when we don't just study our country's history. This really gives some great history of a country we probably don't know much about and have really been told to hate. So from the angle of a cosmonaut who just wants to do the right thing and help this planet, it's a very interesting story to see how we all work together and how countries really do come together to help everyone on this planet. But also how politics play a huge, huge role in all of space exploration. You know, the cosmonauts might not get into it, but the governments are definitely using these cosmonauts and astronauts as a political pawn in many, many ways. So, you know, and the thing that sucks with this one, we had Sergei Korolev, who is very active and one of the heads of the space program now. He was going to be a part of this podcast and he was excited about it, but because of the war, of course, Russia's not allowing him to do any interviews with any American, you know, podcaster. So unfortunately, we do not get to get a brand new interview with him. But what's great about this is we interview all of his friends, all of his colleagues. So you really get to see and hear what was in his head. And it's a beautiful podcast, the way that they bring in the sound effects. And it's one that you want to... I would suggest, you know, if you're in your car driving to work, great. But in the end of the night, when you're ready to go to bed, put those headphones on and just kind of immerse yourself in this beautiful world that they've created with The Last Soviet.
That was Lance Bass, host of The Last Soviet podcast, a production of iHeart Podcast with Kaleidoscope and Samuzdat Audio. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit WMFE.org. Are We There? It is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Bye, bye, bye. Come on, I couldn't help myself. Thanks for listening.